9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Out and about is a go. All systems are nominal. All right, welcome out and abouters. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 and or 92.3 FM, also streaming from kyrs.org. Just a couple of quick news things. You may, if you live out by Camp Sicani, if you're out that way, you may want to check the evacuation orders for where you live. I know a lot of homes have been evacuated out there. We've got a couple other fires going on, so pay attention. It's very windy out there, so watch what you're doing and see if your house, see if where you live is being evacuated. Also, second thing I want to talk about is that a federal judge just issued a preliminary injunction today, temporarily blocking the state from enforcing Idaho's transgender bathroom law, the one that the Republicans said that they were going to require people, the police officers, to make genetic testing. Like, you know, they walk around with genetic testing kits. Anyway, welcome, and I have Christopher Armitage and Dan Brown in the studio with me here today. Hi, guys. How's it going?
It's going great. How about yourself?
It's going pretty good, you know. It's going good.
Right.
Yeah. Did you have a good Pride weekend?
It was exhausting, but it's always invigorating.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was a. Did anybody make it down to the 9 Street party?
No, I didn't. I didn't make it to that.
I was in the booth all day.
And I was just so pooped by that time. It was like there was no way I was going to be able to do it. Now, you know, last time we were here, I think it was Chris and Dan, you guys had both written a new book, I think it was, about conservatism, the America's...
personality disorder.
Personality disorder, right.
Yeah.
And how's that been received?
I think pretty positively. What have you heard, Dan?
All right. And I get a lot of positive comments about it. And people who see it as like a new way of looking at what a conservative is really about.
I couldn't get Alex Jones to sign it. I really tried.
Well, wait long enough, you might be able to. I enjoyed it. It was a really good read, and it was very interesting, and I learned a lot, actually, that I didn't know. And you actually, Christopher, you have kind of branched off into a lot of different things now. Besides being an author, you are running a Substack channel. Is that what you would say, Substack channel? Is that how it...
Yeah, I publish on Medium and Substack and Reddit and I guess, you know, just regular articles that are read pretty almost daily. I write them.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple other things too over the last year, model legislation, leading training for different groups, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. How did you get started on Substack? Because Substack to me seems like the one that really stands out. That if you really want to like subscribe to people who know what they're talking about, that's the one.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, it was, I refused to have any social media like Facebook or Instagram or any of those things, but I wanted to sell books. I also, anytime I've tried to reach out to publishers, I just start thinking I'd rather be writing something new than begging for publishers to publish my work. And also they work on like 18-month timelines. So I knew I wanted to self-publish, and I knew I didn't want to have to use most social media platforms. And so everybody told me there was no way I could make money as an author. I just kept trying, and eventually it worked out. I published on Medium and Substack because they let you build email lists without needing to pay, because normally, you know, like I 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 people, you're going to pay a lot of money for various email management services. But these websites, Medium and Substack, let you do it, and they handle it in platform. I didn't even know you could make money off of Medium. I did know you could make some off Substack. But the whole goal really was just to have email lists to sell my books to people directly and to share excerpts from the books. And it actually just turned into something far more successful than the long form content.
Now, do you find you like Medium better than Substack, or
No, it's a smaller audience, and it's kind of it's more mature in its life cycle. I would say Substack is thriving in a really really fun active community.
Yeah,
but I'd like to continue to find ways to develop my relationship with my audience so that I'm not mostly on one platform. Also, you know, like I have academic work, working papers, and submissions to peer reviewed journals, and I want to find more ways besides just this one platform to really engage with my audience.
Yeah.
Don't forget you've been making appearances across the country too.
Yeah, I've been traveling around the country doing live appearances.
Okay, so how does that work? Do you have like a venue that you go to, and then or is it on air kind of like this, or?
Well, mostly what happens is I get asked to come somewhere, and what I do is I tell them that it'll be like to speak in front of a group, like Charlotte, North Carolina, the Indivisible group there had their 9th anniversary event. And so I was the keynote speaker for that. And then I told them something I like to do when I travel to these areas is meet with local representatives, state house, state senate, mayor, city council. And so they helped arrange that. They also arranged like a radio interview, and I'll also meet with their leadership team, usually maybe do an extra meeting with the that's just more the people who, you know, want to do more of a Q&A or a forum. I'm not really a fan of giving long form pre-written speeches.
Yeah.
Forums are where I thrive. And so I go where I'm invited. I don't solicit for these types of events, but it's been really, really rewarding traveling the country wherever I'm called for and speaking with county Democrat organizations and you know, different groups. There's so many activist organizations out there that just want to have more tools in their hands. And I'm here to just say, here's a hammer and here's a screwdriver.
Well, how does this, when you travel and speak to these different groups around the country, do you feel like there is more energy than there was before, or more hope, or is it people more afraid? What's kind of the mood out there?
Oh, people feel very disempowered in general. They feel like they've been working hard for a decade and things have just gotten worse. But that's part of what they call me for. Mm-hmm. Is I try to be a voice that says we have far more power than we realize. But if you're working in federal politics, then of course you're going to feel like you're spitting into the wind, and then it just comes back and hits you in the face, right? Yeah. But I've just met with a group recently in the Methow Valley called Methow Rising, and there was 150, 200 activists in this barn, and we did a 90-minute Q&A forum, and I said, you know, you guys have two state house representatives here that are Republicans, and they both ran unopposed. I guarantee you those two state house representatives, I can't guarantee, but I'd be very surprised if they have more than 20 volunteers for their campaigns combined.
Yeah.
So in this room, you have 10 times as much human power as they have to run their campaigns. This room could literally, if you decided that you wanted to elect a dog, a golden retriever, to the state house, and Methow Rising wanted to write the agenda, all the policies for that dog, you could get that done.
Yeah.
You totally could. Like, so you guys can pick your candidates, you can set their agenda, and you can get them elected with far more influence. And what are you trying to do at the federal level? Now, sure, there's issues that are going to be more difficult to deal with, you know, but what we can do is things like have universal health care and homelessness, really quality public policy stuff that you've been trying to create replacements or parallel institutions for Medicare and Social Security as those are under attack at the federal level. So 80%, 90% of what you guys want to do, you can not just get it done with a lot of hard work, you can have resounding victories at the state level.
Yeah. And well, and you know, and I think that everybody says, well, the Republicans do outspend us usually, or outspend Democrats usually, but that doesn't necessarily translate to votes. We see that time and time again. I mean, especially on some of these Trump endorsed races.
Yeah. Well, and Hillary outspent Trump, and so did Kamala.
Yep.
And I mean, look, one of the biggest lessons I've been communicating to people is you will never win preaching to the choir. Imagine if there was a religion that just made no effort to try and bring new people in. I guess there are religions that do that. But my point is, you know, go to I grew up Mormon. They knock on your doors. They're trying to bring new people in. They're trying to say, hey, we're trying to save your soul.
Zoroastrian.
Yeah, there you go. And so you have to preach to the uninitiated, and advocate for the things you believe in and bring over converts to democracy, freedom, justice, public policy, ending genocide, good governance.
Yeah.
Bring them to reality, and you're probably going to get 90% no's for every 10% of yeses or maybes, but that's the numbers game. You just got to play them.
Yeah. And Dan, I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here because you are such a mover and shaker in Democratic races or in the party, the local party. Do you feel like where are we at now? I mean, Paul Dillon now is the new head, right? Of our, how are things moving in that direction?
It's more unified. I think there was a lot of divisiveness just personality wise.
Yeah.
And I think we've realized that it's time to get beyond that and look at policy, achieving things and working together.
Okay. Do you feel like sometimes with Chris's kind of what he's saying kind of rubs off on you and you bring that to them?
Well, yeah. What I'm trying to bring is the existential republic. I think the key to it is that a lot of us have felt hopelessness. And I know hope is his hit word that he doesn't use. But
it does.
And built into it, it gives some actual individual action items that people can do. And I think it really feels empowering to do some of those. You know, to write letters to attorney generals, to get local groups together, to start at the local small level and not expect something huge at the national level to happen right away.
Well, and it all goes from the bottom up. That is how change happens. And that doesn't mean just start with your state house or your city council. That means start with your neighbors. If you can't convince your neighbors that universal health care or defunding the organizations that are committing war crimes right now, because most city governments and state governments are investing in companies, you know, on the stock market that do commit war crimes. If you can't convince some of your neighbors of that, you'll never convince your mayor. You'll never convince your governor. You'll never convince the people who, you know, because that's the gatekeepers for everything. All movement, all change for the better comes from the people and from the lowest level. Because that's my favorite people to talk to when traveling politician-wise are state house and state senate representatives, because you can actually move them and their opinions and their policy and their actions using logic and just morals and moral arguments. And you're not going to get that even with your favorite governor.
Yeah. This existentialist republic, that's the name of your Substack too, right?
Yeah, that's my publication.
That's your publication. So, and you just handed me a new book, Toppling Tyrants, which is actually a field guide for people to be able to exercise this. And that's, of course, available in all sorts of places. But this existential List Republic. Why don't you explain that term a little bit?
Sure. Dan mentioned one of my things about the word hope. I'm not a big fan of it. I think that part of why the pro-democracy crowd has gotten so disappointed over and over again is because we set our expectations around the outcome rather than the input. I know in Hinduism there's talks about, Ram said, plant the tree without any concern for what the fruit it might bear will be. And that will lead to you feeling better, more well, more equanimity. And that is the work. You fight fascism because fascism's around, not because you know you're going to win. And when we look at our heroes in the past, Albert Camus, the existentialist absurdist, is a really big hero of mine. And many times during World War II and various other conflicts, things have felt certainly hopeless, no chance, the bad guys are going to win. And our heroes, the people we admire, him in particular for me, are people who stood up anyway and said, well, yeah, however it turns out, I'm going to be one of these people fighting back against the evil, fighting for the people who, you know, fighting for a future we might never get to have. And so existentialism and absurdism, which I'm also a big fan of, but I didn't want to say the absurdist republic. it's really about finding meaning in a world that doesn't hand you meaning a priori. I don't think that we get meaning. That's my personal belief. You don't get meaning given to you before you're alive, and we all have a need inside of us for meaning, but the universe won't just give it to you. So we're, that's the absurdism. The absurdism within the existentialism is that you don't get given meaning even though you desperately need it. And then it is your job to find meaning and value. And for me, my meaning, my value in life comes from fighting back against fascism and authoritarianism and fighting for democracy and freedom and for the betterment of humanity. And I think a lot of other people find meaning in that too.
And I think another personality that brought us together was Viktor Frankl. I discovered Frankl when I was in high school.
Yeah.
His writing, his search for meaning, developed when he was in a prison camp. It all fits together that an individual's choices are strictly an individual's.
Well, and he would notice that there were prisoners, some of the fellow Jewish prisoners that was with him, that they were awful, mm-hmm. that they did awful things, but there were also some of the Nazis that would kind of go out of their way to try to carve out a little bit of kindness, mm-hmm. and it was like that individual thing, and you know this strikes a chord with me because I'm kind of a weirdo because I don't feel nervous and I don't feel scared, I feel really almost grateful for this time that we live in because you can live an ordinary life and be a saint today. You could live a life that people would have called very ordinary 20, 25 years ago just by being a person of honor, a good person, and an honest person. And that is countercultural to this fascism right now. And so you don't have to try that hard, I feel like, to be, I hate to use the word, a saint. You know, and I think that's the beauty of it. I wake up each morning and I think about the things that I'm going to do to combat this, and it makes me really happy. And I would never give them any sorrow, any fear, or any hatred because they get off on it. It's like a sexual thing for them. And so I'm not going to give it to them. And in fact, if this law, this bathroom law, was in effect still in July, we're going camping at Heyburn State Park in July. And my plan was I'm going to use the men's room in a bikini and I'm going to take a shower in there. And if some guy comes in with his son, I'm going to apologize. And I'm going to say, if you vote Republican, you voted to see me in the men's room with you. That's what Republicans want. And so I look for these opportunities and I'm very grateful, actually. That is the gift of the dark times that we're in.
Well, if any Republicans want me to contribute to their genetic material searches, they can give me their hat before I go into the restroom, and I'm happy to give them plenty of genetic material. I've never wished to dress in drag, but maybe this summer is the time I give that a try.
Yeah, maybe.
but I think more, too, about... one of the things I saw when I was in Minneapolis, so in January, February, after the murders of Renee Good and Alex Pretty, I went to Minneapolis to cover the situation and meet with politicians out there, because that's one of the things. I sit down with politicians and I talk to them about public policy, and I sit down with activists and I talk to them about how to better and more effectively advocate for the thing, like who do you ask what to and in what ways. And so I went out there and I saw that the community was gaining strength as things became more challenging. And I've spoken to some people who have been in Ukraine recently, and they say similar things, that you will actually find a lot of joy, you'll find a resilience, and you'll see that as things become more difficult, they become stronger. And so what's the difference between the movements that the two movements can face the same stimuli, and one collapses into hopelessness and one grows into resilience? And understanding the difference between those two those two reactions is what will allow us to make success inevitable against fascism. And the answer isn't hope. The answer is the day-to-day of, I know why I'm here and I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Your courage, infinite courage in all of us, lives in the place where our values and our morals and our meaning live. What are you fighting for, and why are you fighting for it, and who are you fighting for? And you'll have all the courage you need, just like your heroes from World War II, etc.
Yeah, that sounds good. I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, at the trans rights rally, I I wrote a poem and read it that basically had to say that, the same thing, that being a star, that people need to realize that in these dark times, they are stars. Not just stars like, not stars of Hollywood stars, but they are stars that people fix their gaze upon and set their course upon. And that's a responsibility that we have. I've got to do my 20-minute after the hour stuff. But before we do, I would be remiss if we didn't let people know how they can look at your Substack, how they can get your books, all that good stuff.
Check out theexistentialistrepublic.com. Theexistentialistrepublic.com. You can also Google The Existentialist Republic, and that'll get you to either the website or the Substack. And we publish a free article every day. And actually, every book that I write, every article, every booklet, because I've published over a dozen booklets with the Existentialist Republic team, everything's available as a free PDF, no paywall for anything, even my full-length books, because I'm writing this stuff to try and help people make the world a better place. And so I can't, in good conscience, you know, put it behind a paywall.
Well, and you know, what I really liked about your website too is you can do paid subscription, but I also like to buy you a cup of coffee now and again, because that, I think that's a really smart thing to do. You know, maybe people are infrequent readers and they can go on there, and I love that idea. Okay, we're going to, I have to load up all this stuff on the computer to play, but while I'm loading it up, we're going to play the house band, my house band, the Green Warriors, and this was actually from Garland Pride. It's a long song, 622, so we're not going to do all of it, but at least you guys will get a little bit of taste. And this one is called The Sky Is Literally Hot Pink Right Now. Yeah, okay, here we go. Some Green Warriors.
Receive support from Eastern Washington University, the region's polytechnic, offering an increased emphasis on real-world, hands-on learning to build career-ready skills and a lifelong community. More information at ewu.edu.
Out and About receives support from Boots Bakery and Lounge, specializing in vegan bistro fare and gluten-free baked goods. Located in the Saranac Commons, 19 West Main Street in Spokane. Open 7 a.m. through 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. through 5 p.m. Sundays. Full menu and information at bootsbakery.com.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for June 15th through the 18th. Monday, Ron Green at Mary Hill, Extortionist at the Big Dipper, and Primitive Man at Berserk. Monday and Tuesday, Open Jam at Jackson Street. Tuesday, open mic with Nate Dunnigan at The Parlor, Jameson Sampson and the All-Star Jam at Zola, Moonwalker at The Chameleon, and Agent Orange at The Big Dipper. Wednesday, the Night Market with 32 Flavors, Hannah Siglin, Jonah Gallegos, and others at Kendall Yards, open mic at Le Ver, The Dirty Champions, and Aki Fumikado at Zola, Hisentux Himien at The Big Dipper, Alayla Diane and Carly Fairbanks at The Chameleon, and open mic with Derek Hart at The Checkerboard.
Thursday, Mama's Got a Mullet at Garden Gate, Blues Jam at Chan's Red Dragon, Silver Treason at Coeur d'Alene Park and Brown's Addition, the Jason Perry Band at Brick West, the Virginia Rails and Marley Hale at Zola, and Yale Monroe, RCA and the Radicals, and many others at the Chameleon. For an entire hour of local musicians, tune into Sounds of Spokane every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
KYRS exists because of the support of the public. We thank you for giving a little back with sustaining monthly support to continue independent music, local interest, and progressive news programming that is refreshing, engaging, and helps expand perspectives. Just text GIVEKYRS to 44321 and help keep KYRS on the air.
Okay, we are back. The DJ computer has gone crazy. It's filled up with a bunch of extraneous stuff, but I've turned it off. And that, of course, was the Green Warriors with the sky is literally hot pink right now. And I am with Chris Armitage and Dan Brown. And you guys, if it's okay with you, I'm going to read what's going on protest-wise this week. And then we'll jump back into our conversation. If you want to go to, if you go to saveusa.me, I think it is, that you'll find all the listing of everything that's going on. And, of course, Stand Up Spokane, which is on Facebook and Indivisible, Spokane Indivisible too. You can find this stuff. But if you want to support the Spokane 3, and why wouldn't you, go to pajels.org. Protect Spokane's water, power grid, and aquifer. Say no to data centers. Go to www.change.org for that. We've got Get the Ice Out Wednesdays. Every Wednesday, June 17th, and every Wednesday following, 1 to 3 p.m., corner of Washington and Cataldo. That is the ICE downtown field office. We've got the Spokane Visibility Brigade. That is every Thursday at, this Thursday, June 18th, and every Thursday, 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. And that's all the I-90 overpasses, Sherman, Arthur, and Thor. And we have another Say It Saturday, and at B.A. Clark Park, which is at the corner of Empire and Division, pretty much. United Nations World Refugee Day is also Saturday, June 20th. That'll be at Spokane Community College. They'll be honoring that there. Yes for Buses campaign. That is June 20th at Liberty Park near the playground on June 20th as well. If you want to join Pajels, you can go to pajels.org and that'll give you all the explanations for that. Also, Mikey Mondays, every Monday. Next one coming up would be June 22nd, and that is 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. Division and Ruby at the V. That's the median in front of Wendy's there. And kind of to call attention to our own Michael Baumgartner, our Trump sycophant, who's our state Republican in the 5th District, representing us in Congress. Mead School Board meeting to help keep the WSSDA equity statement. If you want to do that, that's Monday, June 22nd, 6 p.m. at Market Street. And I am back, and we are talking to Christopher Armitage and Dan Brown, and we are talking about, mostly about all the stuff that Chris has going on, just a crazy amount of stuff, Substack, books, a podcast, the Existentialist Republic. And I really love the idea about that. It struck a chord with me just a while ago, as Chris explained what that was about. And you've just started a podcast. Why don't you talk about that too?
Well, I do information in a few different locations. The live streams through the podcasting on Substack is a really great format for getting things onto different platforms at the same time. Mostly it's just nice conversations with folks, you know, no clear schedule or anything like that, but doing those live streams and putting them on different platforms, it's great to have long form conversation, really dig into things. And I think it's more accurate to, you know, the holistic approach towards activism that I think we need to have, that if we're not taking care of ourselves spiritually, mentally, physically, then we're unable to have the positive impact we hope to have on the world and on our community.
Well, what you just said begs the question, because you are so
busy doing stuff. How do you take care of yourself?
I don't do a good job at that.
Dan's shaking his head. I mean, it's easy to preach it, but
No, that's my job to say, have you eaten? Did you sit down in the last 15 hours? That kind of thing.
But in
addition to the podcast, the best thing is that these usually go onto YouTube after the podcast. So if you observe the podcast, you can give input at the point, but you can't always schedule things because the people involved are sometimes in totally different time zones. So, you know, you can catch it on YouTube, and it's also fun to watch them again because there are details you will miss the first time through.
Do you find, like in this podcast that people can watch on YouTube, do you find that you are, say you have an idea that you want to hit this week, and so you kind of like take that and then build it in different ways for these different formats for Substack and maybe as a chapter in a book later on and things like that?
Yeah, I would say my curiosity really guides me. What I write day to day that becomes the books, that becomes the conversations I have on podcasts and live streams. And it's all pretty intuitive. And I think that's served me well so far. I used to plan things out more, and I realized that felt constricting, and it slowed down my output. I produce a lot of content in a lot of different spaces because I'm really following what feels interesting to me. And so much of my work has it's like drawing a circle around around something and then realizing the whole time you felt like you were drawing random, you know, circles or marks, and then you find that you're actually drawing a bullseye. And that's kind of like where my career has ended up. In hindsight, feels obvious and inevitable, but at no point was that what I was trying to build towards. And so I take the same approach though with the content and the conversations that I'm having is what is going on. And I mean, especially where's, you know, what's making me anxious, because when I'm anxious about something or upset about something in the world, I ask myself what I can do about it. What power can I exercise or what influence, because that's one of the best ways to deal with anxiety and frustration is just to become empowered.
Yeah. Do you find sometimes upon reflection that's things that you weren't, that maybe you, or maybe you're seeing people spend a lot of energy on subjects that that you kind of go, I don't know, maybe this is something we should reserve our energy for. Do you see that sometimes?
Well, yeah, mostly Trump and what he does day to day. I do what I can to avoid most of the news. A lot of people who I love very much have celebrated this whole Kennedy Center thing. We're funding genocide. We are at war. We're, you know, just killing innocent people. All these truly horrible, the SNAP and Medicaid benefits getting cut, homelessness skyrocketing, all these horrible, heartbreaking things. And I don't want to yuck anybody's yum, but it's just, aren't we playing his game when we're cheering and putting all this attention into his name being taken off a building when these horrible, and you don't have to be miserable. You don't have to be upset even when tragedies are happening. But I mean, and also the articles I see, like if World War II was happening today, this is the early days of World War II, the headlines would be filled with Hitler humiliated again. Goebbels and Goering have their greatest humiliation. Yeah. Like, they love these terms, destroyed, you know, Hitler's been totally destroyed, and it's like early war. And it's like, guys, there's concentration camps and stuff, but I get it. They got to get clicks and that kind of thing, and we all want to feel good. But if you're making yourself feel good over something that is not really, it's not just not helpful, it's actively harmful to the cause of improving the situation to be dishonest with yourself and to make yourself feel good over something that is just a distraction. You're engaging in the distraction and it feels great and you should get to feel good, but it's a lie.
Well, and you know, you talk about like genocide, and of course Israel, who got us into this war, right? I mean, that finally there was an idiot who bit off on what Netanyahu wanted in this war that probably by the time we pay Iran and all the planes that have been destroyed, all the $500 billion probably, and then we don't know how many people have died. They're never going to tell us that, especially the F-15 pilots they supposedly rescued that happened to walk 100 miles away to be rescued by a couple hundred special forces people, which just makes no sense. But so we're not going to know we're not going to know these things. But, you know, you're right. It does take our eyes off of this thing, of this genocide that's being committed, that we are highly culpable, that we could stop immediately. The United States could just say, stop it. Now, I don't know if maybe Netanyahu is compromati on Trump. Maybe that's part of why. That's why he would have never had a security clearance if he had been a rank and file soldier like you and I were. Yeah. He would have never been able to get that just because of his personality and his connections and stuff, because he is highly blackmailable. So maybe that's why. Maybe that's part of the problem too, although I don't know. But how do you, with the press being the way it is, where do you get your information from? Because you can't go to standard news. I read the newspaper every morning and I'm appalled at the things that they leave out of the articles, that really, like the real story that is left out, that you can go to foreign press and read. Where do you get your news from?
Independent media like yourself, the new Fourth Estate, because what we used to call the Fourth Estate, the old journalism is all owned by the oligarchs and a state-sponsored media.
Yeah.
And so you go to independent journalists, people who are, look at who's paying for ad space. Is it local businesses? Is it organizations that care about democracy? That's the filter that I use. I mean, Substack is of course a great resource, and people share their sources, and that's an important thing too. Is outside of just the media platform that you're looking at, when you look at how people are displaying the information that they bring to you, that's really valuable. But also, I don't think you have to pay attention to the day-to-day news to be an effective activist or influencer of positive change in the world. The work that we need to do largely stays the same. And so a lot of what I publish, while I will cover more topical subjects, it's more just to illustrate like the importance of divestment campaigns. We should not be, Google was told in a report that providing services for the state of Israel with a 20-year contract, that they would likely be, almost certainly be, complicit in war crimes. Their CEO was given a report that said that, and they chose to do it anyway. So no city, no state, no investment account, no union should have any money invested with Google. Same for Palantir. They're destabilizing democracies around the world and in America. And guess what? That's against your fiduciary responsibility. If your job is to wisely manage my retirement fund, you better not be putting money into companies that help make wars happen and destabilize developed democracies.
Yeah.
And so that's just one example of how I don't want to watch the news day to day. In fact, the world functioned plenty fine in lots of places where people just read the newspaper once a day or once a week or once a month. That's, I guess, a different way to look at it. It's like you can be fully engaged with the system and not be paying attention to the day to day.
Yeah, that's it'll drive you. It'll drive you nuts. You know.
Well, I am a news junkie, but I have evolved over the years, and my two sources daily are Deutsche Welle and BBC.
Okay.
Because they do not have the corporate influence that, say, CBS and, what they're doing politically, for instance. I like to have their perspectives, and they do cover immediate occurrences, but they also do more long-term perspective and a lot of individual interviews that I enjoy. And that's sort of like what you get on Substack. You get individuals' perspectives and viewpoints and not the corporate message.
Yeah, you just got to look at who's funding whatever it is. That's what I tell people. I mean, Sarah Kendzior on Substack is good. Todd Snyder. I guess that's another thing I would tell people is find individuals who you feel you can trust more than a network. Get to know a name and their background. If somebody spent their career studying authoritarianism and, constitutional law and being a public advocate, that's a trusted position who you get your news from. Yeah. So get to know that person.
Well, I think we've gotten to this place. I think you could go back to like Rush Limbaugh in the beginning of Fox News and say, this is where we were always going to wind up. People would listen to these awful things, and they needed this. They had this hunger for more and more awful stuff, lies. And so this is where the Republican Party was always going going to be. And especially now when there is no fear of, like you're talking about, you know, committing war crimes by Google, there's no fear of justice right now. You know, there's no, especially if you're wealthy, you don't have to fear justice. And if you're in politics, you don't have to fear justice. And I just don't see, I mean, I'm a practitioner of nonviolence, and that's because that's coming from who I am. I don't want to be a violent person, but I don't see any way out of this without reestablishing justice. And I mean, that means Nuremberg type trials. That means people being put in prison and worse and all that, because there's never, I think any country that would have to deal with us at this point would have to say they're just one presidential election away from doing something even worse than what they did with Trump. So how do we make that happen? Is that something that is good to happen?
Well, oh, absolutely. I published a piece just a few days ago about what an Epstein commission could look like, or a Trump commission post, if Democrats retook control federally. I do think we're past that point. I think federal elections have become so... good luck finding someone who's talking in good faith and well-informed who is going to say that things aren't already unfair. Every single Republican-run state is doing everything they can with no guardrails to make sure that elections are not free or fair. They have never been free or fair in most of these Republican states or in most of the country. So already they, you know, plenty of cheating, much more to come. So those are largely a wash, even in a once in a landslide generation, and you even crack through the Fox News propaganda bubble, you're still looking at things being so unfairly tilted that like a 15 percentage point win for Democrats gives them a slim majority at the federal level. That's not enough to make these, that's not enough to convict on impeachment. That's not enough to add a constitutional amendment. That's not enough to overturn an election. That's not enough, or not overturn an election, sorry, but overturn a veto. That's not enough to impeach corrupt members of the federal bench and of the Supreme Court. How do you fix things? We had from 2020 to 2024 to put Donald freaking Trump in jail. I mean, 34 felonies, all sorts of RICO case, a literal coup at the start of him losing his seat. Yeah. In 4 years, he becomes president again and the revenge tour starts. We couldn't get it done then. Why would it now be? Things are worse now. They've purged the federal government. And so I've spent a lot of energy telling you what's wrong. I'm going to tell you the solution that I back is what my academic work supports. So next month I can submit it. I have a working paper out now, so it's kind of a pre-peer review thing where people can look at it. It's constitutional law. It's called the taxonomy of state level response to federal authoritarian capture. And so next month I'll be submitting it to Yale when they open up for peer review in their law journal. It's a taxonomy of federal state response to federal authoritarian capture. It's just saying that over the last 250 years, states have had these five different ways of interacting with the federal government, five different postures. The tier zero is just where states are interacting positively in a friendly manner to agree on, you know, on agreed upon goals. Tier one is uncooperative federalism. That is the states saying, we don't have to help you do things we disagree with. Tier two, soft secession, financial independence. It's the quiet quitting of governance. It's harm reduction for when your federal government's been taken over by autocrats. It's saying, we're going to build healthy non-tax revenue streams. That means ways to make money besides taxes, usually through revenue generating public options like the Bank of North Dakota. We're going to use that to fund social safety nets so that we can, again, harm reduction for the public. Tier three is oppositional federalism. That's using the dual sovereignty doctrine. That means that states have their own criminal codes that they're allowed to pursue. Double jeopardy doesn't count with state charges versus federal, is because both are their own sovereign, their own entity with their own laws, and they have a right to enforce them that isn't canceled out by the other. So tier three oppositional federalism is saying states can charge Donald Trump for crimes. They can charge Cash Patel. They can charge ICE agents. That is long-standing precedent. This isn't something I'm inventing. It's 250 years of how this government was founded to be created explicitly, because we have checks and balances beyond just the three branches of our federal government. Every city government, every state government, and every individual in this country is a check and a balance on federal power. And then tier four, which is a constitutional defiance, which is actually stepping in the way.
Okay. Wow. That's a lot of different options.
Yeah. And that the effective response is just taking things that we already do. Look at cannabis decriminalization and legalization. That exists on multiple tiers of the framework that I just outlined. That framework is just saying we have precedent, we have Supreme Court decisions, we have case law, we have things that states have done recently and far into the past. We can organize these into a state-level response to create healthy social safety nets in our state, to criminally prosecute corrupt federal officials, to step in the way when horrible things are happening, to divest from horrible things, and even in extreme cases to say if you cross a constitutional boundary to an extreme enough degree as the federal government, then we are going to withhold funds from you. You break the Constitution, it no longer binds us anymore.
Yeah, I just read that. I read that today that you said that. And I mean, how do people participate in that? How do we, I mean, that's certainly on the state legislative agenda, I suppose, but how do we as grassroots people enable that?
So at the Existentialist Republic, we've created an activism model for people to become an effective activist of one. So that way you don't need a 501c3. Or 501c4, you don't need to elect a board, you don't need to open a bank account, you can be an effective activist of one using what I just shared with you. And so it's largely built around the work of Sarah Kendzior, Erica Chenoweth, and a few other the folks who wrote The Dictator's Handbook, which I'd really recommend to people, about selectorate theory. It's educate, activate, recruit, repeat. The booklet that we have available for free and for purchase is called Grab Them by the Ear, How to Get Politicians to Do What You Want. So first, you educate yourself and you educate others. You learn about what effective policy is. You learn about who you go to for that. You learn about the different ways to communicate with them. Second, you act. You do the thing. You help influence a little bit every day. One sec. Dan, you want to weigh in a little bit? I got a cough.
Oh, I don't want to take your.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry.
Okay,
I had to cough. Recruit is the third one.
Last week I was doing the same thing.
He's getting himself worked up again. This happens.
Educate, activate, recruit is the third one. You got to preach to the uninitiated. If the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints can knock on your door, and some little 18-year-old can tell you about Heavenly Father and get the door slammed in their face and skip on over to the next house, we can do that to talk about organized labor. To talk about universal health care at the state level, to talk about public banking as the funding mechanism so that we can have a strong social safety net at the state level. We're going to have to learn, whether it was starting this country, abolishing slavery, setting up organized labor, every great change, the civil rights movement, it came from educating the public. You know, the Black Panthers handing out pamphlets along with free school lunch. That's how we get it done. And then, of course, repeat. Educate, activate, recruit, repeat.
Okay. It's people, I think, put so much on Donald Trump as far as like a being the figurehead of all this stuff. But I think they don't realize that when he is gone, however that happens, the people who still worship him are still going to be there. And that's probably, I would imagine, probably about a third of us are in a cult in the United States and are, to my mind, unreachable. Do you find that there is a way to reach them and bring them out of the cult, or do we just write them off?
Right. I want to write them off. I want to just have Washington State would be a great country on its own.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that we need full-blown secession, not because I don't think it's a great option, just because I think that's the soft secession, state-level response stuff that I promote. It's a middle ground. It leaves us room. It's a moderate position. It leaves us room to pivot back towards the current model. Well, not the current model. The current model has a lot of improving to do. But to pivot back towards being a unified nation, or even to pivot towards a more cohesive form of balkanization or splitting into different nations, or even a European Union type model. Because right now, I will tell you, I don't want the people of Louisiana and Kentucky deciding how Washington State educates in our public schools.
Yeah.
I would guess about half of them probably believe in dragons more than they believe in any sort of modern medicine or fMRIs or anything like that. And if they want to tell me I'm wrong, I'm going to say thanks for educating yourself to reality instead of believing in fairy tales.
Well, and also that we give them a big share of our tax dollars.
Oh, too. Yeah. They're the welfare queen of states. And then they want to spit in the face of the economic engines of this country are blue states. Yeah. Blue states are the ones that value human life. Blue states are the ones that have functioning governments. And as soon as we can do away with some of this neoliberalism and actually create even more effective public policy, we'll get to have balanced budgets and healthy social safety nets. Because if you want to be fiscally responsible, there's some great non-tax revenue streams that benefit the public.
And these people also really get excited when you engage with them and try to argue with them. So that's why I just absolutely refuse to have any conversation with them. You know, it gives me great satisfaction. It frustrates them. And that's even adds to my satisfaction of not engaging in these arguments, because I am absolutely convinced you aren't going to change their minds.
We'll get farther just by making our cities run well and our states run well where we have them. Spokane has competent people steering the ship. I have complaints, mostly the lack of ambition, though.
Yeah.
And I'd say that I say that to the people who I really love who are on, you know, city council and the mayor's office and at the state level, too. Washington's a state of competent administrators who lack ambition.
Yeah.
You know, and we need it because, God, the problem is.
Well, I think they're afraid that, we don't want to anger these people. It's like, well, they're already angry.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do. Why not inspire us? Why not be bold? That's what gets me about the affordability thing. Kamala ran on affordability. So I wish they would quit talking about affordability, because tomorrow we could dump the price of gasoline, all that stuff. The problem is justice. And justice costs you money. Fascism costs you money. It costs you more than money, but it costs you money. And so we take care of the fascism. It's going to take care of itself.
Yeah, you got to go on the offense. We've lost because of a timidity. But here's the thing is for candidates that take corporate money or are too cozy with oligarchs, they're never going to be the middle ground, the Kamala Harris style. You're never going to satisfy anybody, because the Republicans are going to do a better job of making corporations and oligarchs happy. And the non-corporate candidates on the quote-unquote left, I'd call it the common sense side, those are the candidates that are just going to do the best job of providing for the public. And so what does that leave in the middle? The people who are doing a bad job at making the corporations happy and a bad job at making... They're never going to be as good as the Republicans at pleasing oligarchs. They're never going to be as good as the proper left or the proper common sense lane at helping the people.
Yeah. This is kind of a big question with only a couple minutes to answer. But what about AI seems to be something that, is kind of cutting across a lot of different sectors. Do you find any hope in that as far as a unification of maybe drawing some people out? Because I think, I used to be one of these people like, there'd be some mostly good things that come out of it. But now I'm pretty much solidly, especially with the data centers and what they're going to do. I think they're just, it's awful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of risk with the AI, but I will say there's an interesting thing. The data centers really seem to be uniting working class people.
Yes.
In a way that I see a similar energy to the anti-vax movement, but in a more bipartisan way, and obviously attached to real problems, not just conspiracy theories. That gives me some hope. It would be really fascinating if we're just one issue that's the right issue, that's really like one issue away from things getting better, because enough of the public is really easily angry about it and kind of wrap their heads around it. So I don't know. It might be kind of an interesting outcome that's unanticipated.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Well, I'm really excited to follow this, because one of our county commissioners some time ago wanted to give a tax incentive to build data centers.
Al French, yeah.
Exactly. And people are wondering after this, what happened this last week, who's going to take the action? I mean, the city is taking action to ban data centers, but it wasn't going to happen in the city anyway. So it's a county thing. At least two of the county commissioners are solidly against data centers. That leaves the three. It'll be really interesting to see if they really respond to the public, or are they just responding to the corporate?
Well, they always care about what's going to lose them elections. And all it takes is a couple elections of people really getting walloped and huge swings. That really could be the thing that saves us. It might, even if it's not that issue, it's just something that's easy enough for the public to understand and moves on Facebook really effectively. And the data center thing, it's like, yeah, it's bad for the...
It's very emblematic. I mean, bad for the environment, bad for us, bad economically. And you're going to basically subsidize billionaires so they can take your job away from you. You know, it's like, and I think that's pretty easy for people to understand. Okay, one last time, tell people how they can get your books and read your stuff.
The Existentialist Republic. You can just Google that. The Existentialist Republic or theexistentialistrepublic.com. We sell our books on there, and that way you don't have to buy it from Amazon, and the Existentialist Republic on Substack, and great articles, model legislation you can send to your representatives, a dozen booklets that we have in paid and free versions that talk about how you can be a more effective activist and what good public policy looks like in a way that the average person can get on board with and understand. And so check those things out if you get a chance.
Amen. All right. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Dan. Great having you guys here. And everybody, you are listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, on 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
Step right up, folks. Please don't crowd. Plenty here for everyone. Welcome to the bonanza extravaganza of the artificial intelligence boom. Silicon Valley billionaires are now proposing a scheme to deliver an unbelievable windfall to, quote, every citizen. Tech titans like Sam Altman of OpenAI are pushing the federal government to create a public wealth fund to let us commoners be investment partners in building the AI wonder world. Lest you worry that this might be a corporate scam, note that Donald Trump, the deal maker in chief, exults that letting the American public buy into the tech boom is a sure bet to, quote, make them rich. And Altman adds that a public investment fund would allow Joe and Jill Schmo to, quote, participate directly in the upside of AI-driven growth. Wow, benevolent capitalism. But wait, aren't AI barons infamous greed heads who constantly rig the system for themselves, sneer at the public, and openly disdain government programs? Well, yes. And wait again, they say we should share in the upside of AI, but what about the downside? Far from profitable, all of the industry's powerhouses, including OpenAI, are losing hundreds of billions of dollars while carelessly adding trillions in new debt and, quietly admitting that their razzle-dazzle computer fantasies might not work. This is Jim Hightower saying they won't tell you this, but going bust is a real possibility. And that is why AI's private enterprise whizzes are now so desperately pushing us taxpayers to become their socialist partners. You see, even when they fail, your and my role is to save their bacon by demanding that we, the public, deserves a government bailout. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
You are listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM, your thin air community radio.
KYRS Medical Lake, and K222BG Dartford, 88.1 FM and 92.3 FM, Thin Air Community Radio.
The following program was pre-recorded.